Hello to our loyal listeners, and welcome back to another episode of Miss On Sand with Xavier and Alan. As always, we'll be looking at all manner of film and theatre from around the world. Now, remember to like, follow, or subscribe to our show using your favourite listening platform, and also check us out and follow us on Facebook and Instagram to get sneak peeks at upcoming episodes and some bonus content. This week, we're stepping into the 1960s era for One Night in Miami from 2020. So, hello, Alan, and let's get going.
Hello, Sam, and of course, hello to our favourite fans. Welcome back to Mise en Scene. Before we boisterously start debating about each other's commitment levels to our causes, I want to make our usual disclaimer that our podcasts are best saved for those who have seen the film prior, and as always, spoiler warnings ahead. This week, we're looking at One Night in Miami, which is a 2020 film directed by Regina King with a screenplay written by Ken Powers. The film is also based on a stage play by Ken Powers called One Night in Miami. To give our listeners a quick brief, I'll just provide a brief summary of the plot before we start breaking down the film. So, this is a fictional account of one inconceivable night where legends and icons Sam Cooke, Muhammad Ali, Jim Brown, and Malcolm X all congregate discussing their roles in the civil rights movement and cultural upheaval of the 1960s. The film kicks off after the final bell of the Boxing World Championships in a low-key after-party that soon becomes impromptu roundtable on obligations, political actions, and in some cases, accusations of inaction. They also talk about fame of African-American celebrities in the time of national crisis. So, Saif, what did you think of this film?
I wasn't too sure what to think of this film going into it, but as I got into it very quickly, sort of found that the film captured what I imagine the 1960s would have felt like across a diverse spread of people and locales. Unlike Ma Rainey, where the whole story largely took place in one location, while this film does very similar, there are a number of other elements and locales that we actually see in the film, which gives us a little bit more diversity than we otherwise saw in previous films. And obviously, we knew what was going to occur in this film in terms of whether it was talking about racism and injustice and justice and black versus white and that whole arena of American sort of civil rights movement that you mentioned in the 1960s. So there was an element of predictability in this film, which, given the context, essentially was a given. But sadly for me, it meant that once again, this was a film that lacked anything new and it was just sort of beating the same old drum. And for me, that was a little bit disappointing because on the whole, I found this film particularly underwhelming. It didn't give us anything new or different story-wise. And stylistically, it was what one expected of this type of film. And like Ma Rainey, I expect it will be successful so far as the awards are concerned due to the social messages it's pandering to. But I feel like this is the sort of content that could be so much better and go for so much more, especially given the caliber of the people being portrayed and the power and the importance of the actual messages that it is essentially dealing with and what is currently, as I said, on the agenda of the public. And it's not that I dislike this type of film, it's just that I wish they went for more than they do because we've seen this before. So while I thought this was an enjoyable enough film, and I thought it was an interesting look and an interesting take at these characters, and it is worth mentioning too that while this story says it's based on a true story, this largely is a fictional account. This isn't actually something that happened like this. It was enjoyable enough for me, but I didn't think it was particularly brilliant. So what did you think of it?
So to be completely honest with you, say, even though we've discussed this before in previous podcasts, I think that when stage plays are being converted into movies, they need that additional cinematic panache to take the screenplay to the next level. And all these men are celebrities in their own right, but to each other, they're forecasters, just simply friends and acquaintances, unafraid to challenge each other's views on the present and the future of civil rights movements and essentially Black America.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned that some of these films may need additional panache to actually take a screenplay to the next level because, as we said, this is an adaptation of a stage play. And as I said, you know, previously, Ma Rainey sort of didn't really feel like it cut it for me because it still essentially felt like a stage play that had just been filmed. For this film, I felt quite differently. I actually felt like this film had covered those elements quite well and that this was a microcosm of the world in which these four celebrities were living because we sat in that room and we listened to their issues and their conversations and their discussions and thoughts on issues in the 1960s. But by the same token, we saw enough outside the room to feel like we were still part of a very real world. And I really quite enjoyed the fact that we did actually feel the world outside of that room too and how it impacted on the four men in the room.
Yeah, look, I think you're right about like the difference between Ma Rainey and this particular film. But I have to suggest, does that have to do with the narrative of the actual play? Because maybe there are more locales and locations in this play compared to Ma Rainey that makes filming and having like a cinematic presence more real. Now, say, I can surely correspond to your views about the film like capturing the essence of the 60s due to this being based on a stage play, but I can imagine them wanting to keep the numbers of the sets limited and like necessary to the narrative. But of the sets we're given, it's truly delightful construction of the 60s, and the ones that stood out for me were the liquor store and the exterior of the motel.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I guess this comes back to what I say about we see enough of the world outside of this room. Because, yes, when you did see the outside of this hotel, because it very much in itself did give off that 1960s vibe, you did feel like you were somewhere else out in the actual world. You weren't just constrained to this room. So, yeah, I agree with you completely that while the sets may have been few, the construction of them to give us that feel was very well done.
Yeah. And I had a contrasting opinion about the predictability of the film that you referenced earlier. Even though we know the outcome of these lived characters based on what history tells us, I think what the film is attempting to do, and this in my opinion has done relatively successfully, is that the fictional dialogue between some of the mavericks and pioneers in the civil rights movement and what those conversations would have looked like at the moment in time, I find the concept rather endearing, and I think Regina for the most part has executed it successfully. Yes, we know that Malcolm will ultimately get assassinated, but the viewer gets to be exposed to him vocalizing his potential omens of death, and you know, it just makes you wonder if he truly felt something ominous was about to be bestowed upon him, or whether he was perpetually suffering from paranoia.
That was interesting, because you did get the feel of paranoia from him, and I haven't read his autobiography, which we sort of see a manuscript of sitting on the table towards the end of the film. So I don't know how much of this character development, be it in the stage play or the screenplay, was actually accurate. I have read a number of conflicting things suggesting the portrayal of some of these characters, such as Malcolm X, was way off the mark. But nonetheless, it was interesting to have a look at these four key characters in terms of the civil rights movement and their fame at the time, and potential conversations that may have actually occurred between them, whether they did or not. I have no doubt that people of this ilk would have had some sort of discussions amongst themselves about issues that were prevalent for them at the time.
So, say, you mentioned there were some underwhelming aspects of this film that you didn't like, and how there wasn't anything new in terms of storyline, but I like to oppose that opinion and express another train of thought. Look, maybe there wasn't meant to be anything new in terms of content. The stars of the shows weren't necessarily the personalities of the characters being inhabited, or even the actors who portrayed them. I think the star is the words expressed, the ideas interchanged, and the concept of philosophies challenged and debated on. I believe that, you know, this was the true essence of the film, and the actors were just mere vessels for creative explorations of these notions.
Oh, I agree with you completely there. I have no doubt that the words were what was the most important thing in this film, not the actual characters themselves. It wasn't about, you know, whether it's Cassius Clay or Malcolm X or anything like that. It is very much about the dialogue in which they were having and how those words were pertinent to the time. I guess the issue I have with this, though, is that this is a film we're watching in 2020, 2021, and it's not dealing with issues that are in the here and now, but it's not necessarily clear on saying these are the issues that are still prevalent in the here and now that are still, you know, there 60 years post-fact. So I guess what concerns me with a film of this ilk is, what is it actually trying to do? What is its agenda? Why, if you're going to have such powerful words, are you only going to focus on potentially the dark times of 60 years ago without lending a perspective or a lens on how these things can still be pertinent to now, or how things have improved, or how things have just changed? There may be similar issues, there may be the same issues, but I just wish the film had sort of offered us a little bit more, because this was a very charged film in terms of what was being discussed and the ideas and concepts, and rightly so, because these were massively issues with a huge amount of anger and passion behind them in the 1960s. But when that is just brought forward to 2020, 2021 with that anger and passion and almost this flavor of hatred, I do have to wonder why it didn't give us something else to actually balance it out. But it was just a thought.
All right, so Save, you talk about issues that may be relevant to the here and now. So let's talk about the characters that are involved in this movie. And maybe we can unpack to see what motivated them and what relevance we can find in their characters and in the dialogue that may be pertinent to the modern day.
Yep, for sure.
So I think it's important to first acknowledge how intimidating of a mission it must have been for the cast of the film to take on such prominent characters, you know, some of which who have been immortalized on screen prior through other actors. For example, Denzel Washington, who portrays Malcolm X. So Let's just start with him, Malcolm X. And in this particular film, he's played by Kingsley Ben-Adir. So Kingsley Ben-Adir portrays Malcolm as someone, you know, who is less confident, you know, as we'd expect him to be, and an influential Cicero rather than an intelligent, apprehensive man who's enduring his own quagmire. But we are reminded early in the first act of his deteriorating relationship with the leader of the Nation of Islam, Elijah Muhammad. Now, even though there aren't many exposition scenes explaining in depth the reasons why, we have to piece together that this is due to this authoritarian doctrinism and predacious sexual behavior that Elijah exhibits. Now, Malcolm's ace up his sleeve is Cassius Clay, which he plans on using as a pivot to start his organization. The genuinity of this relationship with Cassius is challenged in a powerful scene towards the end, leaving the viewer with an open-ended question about the flaws of men and to what extent one might go to relish their own agenda.
Not being particularly well-versed on Malcolm X myself in terms of who he was as a real individual, what he was like in day-to-day life, you know, not seeing much in terms of actual, you know, archival footage of him back in the 1960s, it was very difficult for me to ratify how well Malcolm X was portrayed in this film versus in reality. I like to think that it was somewhat close to him, but again, as I've said previously, I've read a number of things that suggested the portrayal of characters in this film were a little bit off.
So, Save, you just mentioned that some people have mentioned that this might not be an accurate portrayal of these characters. And I think I have to agree with you because based on other cinematic experiences that we've had with Malcolm X, he's a very fiery, vibrant person. You know, he's very prowess in his demeanor. And in this film, we see him very suppressed. You know, maybe this is because this is towards the end of his tenure with the Nation of Islam. And he does sincerely have these omens of death and darkness that surround him and his thoughts, or maybe that's just how he felt as a person in this particular situation. But I think that's a great point that you do bring up.
The character of Malcolm X in this film was actually somewhat interesting for me, and I'll start off with a little bit of the issues a number of people have had that I've sort of read in some of the reviews, and a lot of people have complained about the fact that Malcolm X was portrayed, obviously, in the way he was in this film, but that a lot of people have sort of argued that that's not what Malcolm X was necessarily like in real life. Now, whether that's their perception of him because they lived through the time at which he was actually alive, or whether they've seen, you know, archival footage of him doing speeches and presentations and whatnot and stand out for civil rights back in the 1960s, I don't know. I'm not well enough versed on Malcolm X, but it was interesting for me that enough people from both sides of the fence, be they white or black, and particularly of American populations, have criticized the portrayal of Malcolm X in particular in this film. And again, I don't know enough about it to make an educated statement on this, so I'm going to leave that alone. But as a character itself, one of the things I found with Malcolm X was that it took a very unexpected aim at how racist and agendered blacks could be. And obviously, it's set it in the 1960s, but there's that big discussion between Sam and Malcolm and that sort of infighting, conflict of opinion, and the conflicting interests that different people may have had within certain groups. And I almost felt like they'd taken Malcolm X too far in some regards. Now, again, I'm not particularly well versed in the actual historics of this and how accurate this was, but I did almost feel like they had given too much fire, too much anger to the character of Malcolm X, and that it just didn't quite gel on screen with the other three characters, because while they all gave a slightly more balanced viewpoint and in some ways actually leveled out the character of Malcolm X, as a viewer, it just felt a little bit overcharged, as though it was trying to use these words to say more than what necessarily would have been intended had they actually occurred in the 1960s. But that was just a feeling I got from the film. Whether it's right, wrong, or Malcolm X may have actually, you know, been much like that, I really don't know.
So say, the juxtaposition of Malcolm's views and philosophies is actually embodied by Sam Cooke, played by Leslie Odom Jr. Now, we are shown a small flashback scene with Sam being met with a dispassionate acclamation from a New York audience who he's trying to allure. Now, this sets the stage for the thought process of Sam and how he views his role in the movement. We're given a few anecdotes regarding how he believes he's helping the cause. Now, according to Malcolm, Cook doesn't seem to realize that his voice can be as potent as Malcolm's orations. During the discourse between him and Malcolm, we see that Cook is actually offended by Malcolm's insinuation that his business acumen is not viewed to be beneficial to the civil rights movement. Now, Omar Odom, who plays Cook, exhibits his amazing vocals like he did in Hamilton when he played George Washington. The musical performance of Chain Gang almost rocks the screen, and especially at the end of the film, the song A Change Is Gonna Come just sort of cements his transition of philosophy.
I will just start actually with your little mention of the last song that occurs in the film, because for me, the final Sam Cooke song was sort of the message delivered at an appropriate time. Now, that may not be the exact wording that was used in the film, but it almost blatantly suggested this film's sole purpose is to drive a causality of action and conflict at a time when it's back on the public agenda. But again, for me, as I'd said earlier, it was only sort of sadly rehashed the past rather than offering something new or aspirational. But in terms of the character delivery itself, I felt that Sam Cooke was quite a good character because he did show this depth that went beyond the anger of Malcolm X and sort of the slightly more stoic attitude that the likes of Jim Brown actually brought to the table. And this comes back to what I mentioned earlier, where I was saying that Malcolm X and Sam Cooke and sort of their conflict between the two of them was where I found that Malcolm X, obviously, to my mind, may have been a little bit over the top and a bit exaggerated in his character, because I don't feel like this conflict between the two characters would have been quite that antagonistic against each other. But it was an interesting look at the discourse between the two. And again, obviously, this is a fictitious account, but it did sort of highlight some discrepancies that you do see in any culture, not just necessarily black culture, and certainly not just of the 1960s, where people fighting for similar causes can have very different paths in which they want to walk to get to a common goal. And I really felt like the character of Sam Cooke lent that other perspective and that other angle to say that there are other ways to achieve goals. And just because I'm doing it my way doesn't mean I'm any less passionate about what I'm actually trying to achieve, or that my way is any less important or less valuable or less attainable than the way that anyone else is achieving, which may be louder in other ways. For instance, Malcolm X might be loud on a podium, you know, yelling to a crowd, but Sam Cooke's is equally loud, and as you say, has that power, that potency that he can bring through music and the crowds that actually sit with him. It was interesting that the crowd was sort of uncomfortable in New York and didn't really warm to him, didn't want him there. Obviously, that was a very racially charged scene, but you sort of had that offset by this powerful, beautiful song of Sam Cooke and his delivery there and how it sort of fell on flat ears. So for me, the character of Sam Cooke was probably one of the ones that had the most depth, while at the same time also saying, in large part, the most.
Look, I think you're right. I think Sam Cooke did have a very in-depth character profile, and it was also similar to the Malcolm X profile that we just discussed. But what makes Sam likable for me, like you just mentioned, is his versatility. His thought process and philosophies are not just pandering to the white man, but pandering to empower. And this is what I mean by juxtaposing ideologies and philosophies. And I think that's something that we'll discuss a bit later on. Mm. But you've mentioned Jim Brown, so let me just talk about him briefly. Jim Brown's played by Aldous Hodge, and he's a quieter and more composed member of the four. Brown is projected to be gradually fed up in the manner that African-American athletes are being subjugated and turned into commodities. You know, he sees Hollywood to be a way out or an alternate path, and I found the dialogue between him and Cassius to be relevant. You know, will his fame in Hollywood only last as long as he's a prominent athlete on the field, or can this symbiotic relationship be challenged or even changed?
Yeah, I actually want to say that as much depth as there was to the character of Malcolm X and Sam Cooke, I actually really liked Jim Brown. And Jim Brown was probably actually my favorite character in this whole film, because I felt like he didn't come across as antagonistic or particularly agendaed. He wanted change and he was willing to work at it, but he wasn't going to burn his bridges along the way. He knew what he wanted. He knew how he wanted to get there. And he was going to get there on his own terms. He wasn't going to set a fire under anyone, and he wasn't going to go out of his way to basically paint a target on his back in the way that the likes of Malcolm X ultimately did. And when you had those interactions between him and at the old homestead where his family had obviously grown up, and then there's a racial slur, it really gives you this interesting idea of how this character behaves and reacts to certain environments and stimuli, because I feel for some of the characters, they would have actually stood up to that and I guess made a scene, and it wouldn't necessarily have been unwarranted. But Jim, on the other hand, sort of goes, I'm not going to say anything. I'm going to take a step back. And you just know that he's essentially cut this person out of his life, that this person's not worth it, and that he's ultimately going to change society by the way he carries himself and the way he deals with the people around him. He's not going to go after them. And I found that that was a really interesting thing, and it was probably one of the best elements that I could actually tie to modern day society in the way these issues are handled, because we do have a lot of people that stand up and yell and shout and talk down to people from both sides of the fence. But then you also get the moderates that sort of sit on the fence and go, I'm actually going to listen to both sides of the argument, and I've always felt personally, and this is something I learned during debating at school, you have no right to argue a case either way until you are capable of understanding it well enough to argue it both ways. And for me, I felt like Jim Brown was that character because he understood the plight of the African-American man and issues that they faced in society, but he also understood why some of those issues occurred and why sometimes being antagonistic was counterproductive, and that you actually needed to get some of these people on side, and the ones that you just couldn't get on side, they weren't worth yelling at or down to or across at, because those people were never going to change, that it was basically steeped in sort of their history and their upbringing, and essentially you needed those people to ultimately die off, for lack of a better word. So to me, Jim Brown was really this balanced character that, as I said, understood both sides, and I feel like that's a really important commentary on something that's largely missing for a whole variety of issues in this day and age, be it religion, race, gender, equality, all those sorts of things. So I quite enjoyed the character of Jim Brown, and I felt that Aldous Hodge actually did a really good portrayal of him.
It was funny that we were talking about how this movie might relate to modern day times or modern times, but Jim Brown wants to give up his career at the Cleveland Browns to, you know, to go into Hollywood, but now there's accusations of Hollywood not having enough representation, and it becomes that a cyclic thing. And you're right, his character is the most composed because he doesn't give credence to his oppressors or, you know, people who subjugate him to. So he does give a balanced viewpoint. Now, let's talk about Cassius Clay. Now, he's played by Eli Gore. And as Odie Henderson adequately describes, you know, he plays a fast-talking man who commands attention by the virtue of the words he speaks and the cadences in which he spoke them. I feel like Cassius was the mediator of the group, but he was also on his own journey of self-discovery. The Nation of Islam demands more virtue and composure over one's emotions than he's able to currently display. And it's interesting to see how he transitions, or actually we don't even see how he transitions. We just have to accept that a loud, eccentric young man who's successful in his own right, a world champion, ends up embracing calmer aspects and notions and virtues of the Nation of Islam.
Mm-hmm. See, I wasn't too sure about the portrayal of Cassius Clay or Muhammad Ali, as he later became, because I didn't feel like he represented the Muhammad Ali that we knew later in life. And this, again, probably could be an issue due to historical accounts. What we saw of Muhammad Ali often when he was sort of talking about issues was when he was a bit later in life and a bit more mature. For this, I felt he was almost like a lost teenager. And as you say, he was trying to find his own way. He was on his own journey of self-discovery. And I guess for him, going from Cassius Clay to Muhammad Ali, he was in a bit of a state of flux in his own personal life. But for me, I don't necessarily agree that he was the mediator of the group. For me, he was almost like the deciding vote. For me, Jim Brown was very much the mediator. Malcolm X and Sam Cooke were sort of very much the players on either side of the fence. And Muhammad Ali was the one that sort of tried to play the fence, to find that middle ground between the two and be that balanced opinion. But ultimately, he needed to pick one way or the other. So for me, he didn't really work as a character because I always think of Muhammad Ali as a very eloquent and strong man who very much knows what he wants, where he's going, and how he wants to get there. And at this stage in the play and the performance in terms of where he's at in his life, I just didn't quite feel like it was the man that we knew and understood that actually would have had the grasp on these topics that he seemed to have in later life. So it was just my opinion, but yeah, I wasn't too sure about the character of Cassius Clay or the portrayal of him by Eli.
So now let's talk about some of the underlying themes that you've noticed.
Well, I guess one of the big ones, which I mentioned earlier, was sort of how this film took an unexpected aim at how racist and agendered blacks can be. And as I said, this came out largely in the Sam versus Malcolm fight, where they're sort of having a bit of an infight, this conflict of opinion, the conflict of interest, which I mentioned before. But likewise, when Jimmy levels with Malcolm after Sam leaves, when they've had this disagreement, as I said, he's the balanced viewpoint of reason. And he goes one further to call out blacks for also being hypocrites and Malcolm for being just as big of a racist and as complicit in the actions of racism as anyone else. And I really didn't expect that in this film, but I felt like it touched on something very, very powerful and equally as important today as it probably was in the 60s and for many generations before that. How did you feel about that?
So, look, I think it's a very interesting point that you've just mentioned there. And I think that's something that I definitely picked up as well, especially when Jim Brown talks about the animosity or this unspoken animosity between light-skinned people in the black community versus dark-skinned people in the black community, and how a light-skinned people are continuously trying to prove their worth. And he sort of accuses, or he sort of alludes to, that Malcolm, the reason for his fire is fundamentally based on his light skin, his constant need to approve. It's not just driven by the constant need to fight for civil rights, but it's the constant need to fit into his own community. And I think that was a very interesting dialogue that we experienced during the movie.
It was for sure. And as I said, it was something I didn't expect, was this conflict between ultimately different shades of black, because it is a very powerful thing. But likewise, I also think that films like this can be construed as socially divisive and dangerous, particularly when it gets into this sort of territory, because, okay, there's black versus white, and then you sort of go into black versus black, and you sort of all the shades in between. And for me, a lot of this talks about black power and winning and destroying white people, and likewise, you know, how they interact with their own people. But this sort of agenda-driven content often concerns me, is I feel in some way only serves to draw new battle lines by weaponizing the past and not looking at how to solve anything in the future. And I feel like if it's not looking to solve something by constructive means, then I have to question the rationale for its production, because this film went out of its way to deal with a whole raft of issues, deal with four historical figures that were exceptionally powerful, exceptionally well known by all communities around the world, and then deal with issues that were massively, massively present in the 50s and 60s, and a number of which are still to this day. But I feel like it's not just going as far as widening the gulf between black and white society, but it also almost draws these battle lines between individual sects of black society. And that concerns me on the whole, because I feel like drawing these battle lines, or widening the gulf, or pointing out the disparities between different groups, whomever they are, is never going to be a good thing, because it can only ever end in conflict, because you're pointing out these differences and potentially making issues where there may not have been issues. So while I found it interesting at one level, I did also find some of the points this touched on a little bit concerning, because, as I said, I don't feel they necessarily empowered anyone, as opposed to bringing a number of different people down.
Right. Okay, so I think I have an opposing view, because I find that the film echoes the model of a stage play in a way. You know, it uses language instead of the camera to direct attention. And in this particular case, we're so focused on the language used to progress the narrative. And in particular, like, the narrative in this particular case is the dialogue between African-American men about, hey, how to progress in this particular time of the civil rights movement, or what can we do to enhance or to provide or to further our struggle. You do mention the notion of black power, but I think Cassius uses it in a way to sort of say, hold on a second, this is how, you know, this is the inception of that terminology. And for me, that terminology is empowerment. And I think this was just Regina's way of saying, hey, I'm going to give a nod to where this terminology has sort of, you know, was given birth. But I think more than providing divides between communities, I think it highlights discrepancies amongst them. And only when we can identify discrepancies can we attempt to understand the other point of view. So I think that was the angle that Regina was going for.
But I guess, and this is where I come back to my little problem, is that it's all well and good to do something that focuses on issues in the 1960s, but at the end of the day, this is content for the 2020s, and it may well be looking at these divides and issues that were prevalent then and may well be prevalent now. But as I said earlier, if it doesn't offer up something more than just pointing out the issues, if it doesn't make attempt to even have these famous icons say that here's a way that we could deal with it, then I feel like all it does is draw the battle line and then leaves a battlefield. It doesn't actually offer any strategy for anyone moving forward, no matter where they're from.
Well, I think when you say it draws a battle line, it might elicit certain questions like, is black liberation economic freedom? You know, it raises questions like that. And let's just talk about that for a moment. So based on the characters of this film, Cook answers this, or he gives his own interpretation by, he owns his own masters of his songs, and, you know, he enables black musicians to be paid, even though this may result in some of their songs being sold to the Rolling Stones and that particular song going to number one rather than number 98 when the black musician was actually playing it or singing it. He justifies this by saying, we're getting financial economic freedom from every royalty check, and the person who's written this song, the owner of the song, wouldn't have made as much money as you know, as he does now. And then Malcolm goes, no, but that's exactly the point. Why doesn't the owner of a song that has the potential to go to number one when a white man sings it, can only go to 98 when a black man sings it. And I think that's where that dichotomy of relationship and opposing philosophies come to light. This movie is about discussing and just sort of talking about the existing questions at large due to race and things like that. I don't think it's about solving the issues. It's just about having that discussion, having that dialogue. Even Brown, when, you know, like, you know, he's clearly grappling with his subjugation when he's playing football, like when he says, hey, some white folk cannot just wait to pat themselves on the back for not being as cruel to us. But the point he's trying to make is, you know, slavery and, you know, and persecution has ended, you know, years ago. Why are we still getting paid the price now for it in different forms? So I think the question of, is black liberation economic freedom, a intertwining theme between the characters that they have that dialogue between. So say, let's move on to cinematography. What was your take on how this movie was constructed visually and technically?
I didn't feel that there was anything particularly that stood out in this film as exceptional or amazing or particularly well done. But, I mean, there are a couple of artistic shots in this film, and a particular favourite of mine was when we actually looked through Malcolm's camera after Cassius Clay won his title fight, and we actually see Cassius Clay through that viewfinder. For me, that was a really nice shot because it was almost like a snapshot without being a snapshot. It was this historical point. And I don't know if Malcolm X actually did take such a photo of Muhammad Ali or Cassius Clay at the time, but it was a very pretty thing in terms of the cinematography. Other than that, though, nothing else really stood out for me. As I said earlier in this podcast, I did feel like this film captured the essence of the 60s and the feel because we saw inside a room and outside of it a bit. It made for a more dynamic world, even though we were still in relatively few locales and sets. But again, cinematography-wise, I felt like it was effective, but it was nothing necessary to write home about.
Yeah, and I think I'm going to have to completely agree with you. There wasn't anything intricate, you know, that took my breath away, you know, or anything I wanted to comment on. There were a few pan shots and crane shots, you know, moving from the lower floor to the higher floor of the hotel, but this isn't anything to rave about. Tammy Raker, the director of photography, is best known for her work in Lisa Kolodenko's High Art and Beyond the Lights, and her award-winning work for Carnival. But I just wanted to note that Tammy did a decent job on this film, but I don't believe the lack of intricate shots were a reflection on her competence, but the limitations posed on her by the script.
Yeah, and this is an important thing to note too, is that, and we've said this in other podcasts, a film doesn't need to blow you away with cinematography and whatnot. Sometimes the fact that it is effective is all that needs to be. If you don't notice it as being overtly bad and it doesn't stand out to you as too flashy, then as far as I'm concerned, cinematography has done its job, because good cinematography for the most part should be something you don't notice. You just feel like you're a fly on the wall in a room of conversation, or you're flying through a scene, or you are in a car as it races through a town. That is how good cinematography is. It shouldn't be essentially a character in itself, as it might be in the likes of Marvel films where the cameras are spinning around and upside down and, you know, getting blasted away with an explosion. It's not a character in itself. So I think the fact that this cinematography was acceptable and functional and did its job is okay. It's not something that's, you know, suggests dissatisfaction or that it wasn't sufficient. I think quite the opposite. It was perfectly fine.
So say, let's wrap this film up. To all appearances, One Night in Miami seems to be a trifling recital that has been grabbed from a larger social perspective or narrative. What I found compelling was the film doesn't attempt to make any ostentatious proclamations about sport, race, music, or even politics, but it's a more a group of young men bantering. It's a raw insight into communication, vociferous men talking, relinquishing their guard, and at times giving the viewer an insight into their soul. The constituent of the arguments and dialogues are nothing short of captivating, and their voice echoes robustly to modern times. Regina King has managed to deliver a noteworthy film, with its actors being nothing short of captivating, and it's for this reason I give this film a 7.5 out of 10.
Yeah, look, I think for me, this film will almost certainly win an Oscar because it panders to the leftist agenda, which is being heavily peddled as the last half a decade, and increasingly so in the past couple of years, rightly or wrongly. Now, this was a well-made film so far as technical execution is concerned, as we just said, but again, that's nothing new, original, or anything that we haven't necessarily seen before. So as far as I'm concerned, this film merely attempts to use social antagonization as a ploy for a guise of a hard-hitting and timely piece, which I suspect will work because no one really wants to call out this sort of content for the blatant manipulation that is, lest they be publicly crucified for having a different opinion to anyone else, which is somewhat ironic, but there you have it. So for me, I'm only going to give this film a 6.2, unfortunately, because as much as I enjoy it, as I've said throughout this podcast, I did feel like there was a number of sticking points for this film.
Oh, well said. I hope next week's film will earn a high rating in your books. But until then, that's yet to be seen.
Absolutely, absolutely. I hope so too. But until then, that's all from us, folks. We hope you've enjoyed yet another episode from us. So remember to like, follow, or subscribe to our show on your favorite listening platform. And also check us out and follow us on Facebook and Instagram to get sneak peeks at upcoming episodes, as well as some bonus content. And remember, as always, if you enjoy our show, please recommend us to your friends, family, and colleagues for their enjoyment too. But until next week, goodbye.
See you guys. See you next week.